Today's Keisho will be on Case 13 in the Book of Serenity, Lin Ji's Blind Ass. Introduction. Devoted entirely to helping others, you don't know there is self. You should exert the law to the fullest without concern that there be no people. For this, it is necessary to have the ruthless ability to snap a wooden pillar in two. When about to go, what then? Case. When Lin Ji was about to die, he admonished San Sheng, "After I pass on, don't destroy my treasury of the Eye of Truth." San Sheng said, "How dare I destroy the teacher's treasury of the Eye of Truth?" Lin Ji said, "If someone suddenly questioned you about it, how will you reply?" San Sheng immediately shouted. Lin Ji said, "Who would have known that my treasury of the Eye of Truth would perish with this blind ass?" Verse. The robe of faith is imparted at midnight to Wei Nang, stirring up the 700 monks at Wang Mei. The Eye of Truth of the branch of Lin Ji, the blind ass, destroying it, gets the hatred of others. Mind to mind, they seal each other. Patriarch to patriarch, they pass on the land, leveling oceans and mountains, magically producing a phoenix. Just the name and word are hard to compare. In sum, the method is knowing how to fly. Just so we can understand the story, Lin Ji is a great Zen master. In Japanese, they say Rinza. So our particular tradition of Zen practice is Rinzai Zen. If somebody asks you, what kind of Zen do? You can say, "I do Rinzai Zen." It doesn't really matter what kind of Zen you do. There is really no such thing as Zen, actually. And there's really no such thing as Rinzai Zen. Those are just concepts, and they're like giving shiny paper to a little kid to stop it from crying. That's true. But if somebody says, "Well, what kind," when I advertise our group, I never say Rinzai Zen, because people are afraid of Rinzai Zen, because it's known for being, you know, a kind of demanding tradition of practice. In fact, in my wife's bookstore, I did make a poster at one time that said Zen in the Rinzai tradition. And my wife said that two people came in and saw the poster, and one person said, "Oh, there's a Zen group here in Princeton." And somebody said, "Yeah, but it says Rinzai." And they looked at each other, and I guess that meant, "No way." Rinzai Zen starts with Master Lin Ji. And Lin Ji was famous for having a kind of abrupt style of teaching. Different teachers had different styles, different methods of helping people to wake up. So Zhao Zhu was a very gentle and soft person, all very supportive and warm, and was supposed to be very eloquent, as a matter of fact. And that was just his way of manifesting emptiness, a true nature. But Lin Ji was and Zhao Zhu, by the way, was quite big. As a matter of fact, he was a big, big person, physically large. Lin Ji was a physically very small person, and his style was totally different. He was very abrupt and very direct. And you know, if you went into Dokusan and you weren't focused, he might just slap you. You know, really. You know, and he would have a stick in Dokusan, and if people came in and they, you know, their answers were just a bunch of bullshit, look out. You know, he, and you know, he was famous for a shout. You know, people, somebody would come in and, you know, be waiting. This was his style, not of the style of other teachers. But and somebody might come in to call Mu, and if they waited too long, he might just scream. You know, he'd shout, quack, quats, quats, quats. And basically, this was apparently terrifying. You know. So, so that was his style, different style. You know, just different people develop different ways of dealing with reality, and that was one that he found to be effective. And he was quite successful, as a matter of fact. Really, Rinzai Zen became the leading form of Zen in China. And actually, all the temples in China, pretty much, in mainland China, until the Communist Revolution, called themselves Rinzai or Linji temples. Everybody thought Linji was like the highest peak in the mountain range. I personally think they're all wonderful, but Linji is, you know, important. So the case involves Lin Ji, and he's dying. Yeah, he's dying, and so he asks his main student Song Sheng to come, and he says, "Listen, after I'm dead, don't destroy my treasury of the Eye of Truth. You know, don't let this beautiful practice fall apart. Don't." And Song Sheng said, "How would I, you know, I wouldn't let that happen, teacher. Not in a million years." So Lin Ji said, "Well, okay, great. If somebody questions you about it, about, you know, reality, what are you going to say?" Song Sheng immediately went, "Khats!" See? And Lin Ji says, "Oh, cripes." And he said, "Who would have known that my treasury of the Eye of Truth would perish in this blind ass?" And then he just dies on his bed. The, you know. See. So this is a classic Zen story. And it's kind of disappointing in a way. Because what we wanted to have happen was this, you know, Linji's dying, Song Sheng comes in, Linji says, "Listen, don't let it go, don't let it fall apart." And Song Sheng says, "Don't worry, I won't." And Linji says, "Okay, so what are you going to say?" And then Song Sheng's supposed to say something, and Linji's supposed to go, "Great! Oh, it's in good hands. Goodbye." You know? And instead he gives this answer, which is like, that's Lin Ji's answer, right? To shout, "Khats." He goes, "Khats." Lin Ji goes, "Oh, cripes." You know, this is the end. Oh, brother, you know. Now it's in the hands of this ass, this blind ass. Right? It's like so disappointing. And then he dies. That's even a more depressing story than Bodhidharma meeting Emperor Wu of Liang, right? Bodhidharma came to China from India, and some people got him an interview with Emperor Wu of Liang. And, you know, Bodhidharma could go in to see the emperor and say, "Listen, you know, blah, 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 blah," and the emperor would go, "That's fantastic, you know. I'll write you a check right now. How much? You know, a billion? You know, what do you want?" So Bodhidharma goes into with the emperor, and they don't get along at all. Right? You know, the emperor is actually a deeply pious person. He deeply believes in Buddhism, and he says, "So, you know, what's your practice? And, you know, what is the highest truth? Tell me about Zen." And Bodhidharma says, "There's no such thing as Zen. And by the way, there's no such thing as highest truth. Those are just ideas." And the emperor goes, "Well, so, you know, what do you teach? Don't you believe in holiness? Don't you believe in holiness?" And Bodhidharma says, "There's no such thing as holiness. That's just a word. I practice vast emptiness. I practice emptiness. This is the path to liberation." And the emperor just didn't get it. And the interview was over. And Bodhidharma went away. He wasn't successful in his job interview. Yeah. And he went up into the hills and ate acorns and stuff for 11 years. He didn't get the check. Yeah. So this is another. This is even more disappointing, right, than that story, because we're supposed to get at the last minute. The good student's supposed to say exactly the right thing and save the day. And Rinji can die in peace knowing everything's okay. This is what we want. Right? But this isn't what the story says happened. Our discriminating mind is disappointed by this. And it's a little bit like the way we feel when we go into a dokusan. Don't get the approval of the teacher, I understand that Dokusan is a difficult practice, it's difficult to go into that room and present. It's psychologically difficult. How do I know? Because I did it thousands of times, or hundreds anyway. It might be thousand when I think of that. And for some reason it's a frightening to go in there, even though I think you agree that I'm not like Minji, I don't yell, I don't hit anybody, But it's scary, right? And then, you've been practicing all day and you go in and you have an answer that you think is a pretty good answer. And the teacher says no, or you're not there yet, and it's a bitter pill, isn't it? It's a bitter experience, I think. But I think it's a good thing. I mean, I think it forces us to be deeper people. Sometimes you'll come in with an answer, and I will say that's fantastic. You couldn't have done better. That's wonderful. But that's actually not the general Zen style. Generally speaking, in Zen, the style is never to praise too much. A classic teacher would never say, "Oh, that's a fan. You've done it. That's fantastic." The classic teacher would just go, "Oh, well, that's all right. I guess I'll pass that." Even if it's a brilliant answer, the classic teacher would just go, "Oh, I guess I'll let you go on to the next koan." Sometimes, truly, Genki Roshi could be like that sometimes, and actually you wouldn't know if you passed your koan or not. He would say, "Well, did I pass or not?" And he would never allow you to ask that question. It was like he controlled the situation in the dokusan totally. So it was like, you went in there, you presented your answer, and he'd go, "All right, here's a koan for you." That meant, did I pass or did he give up on me? Right? You didn't ever get closure, right? What we want to have is closure, right? This is a big word in closure. This means that you're uncertain, you come in, and the teacher says, "Ah, yes, that is the answer, well done," right? And say, "Ah," it's like a chapter in the book. Now we close, the chapter's over. It's on to the next chapter. It's all nice and neat, right? And this is very reassuring. But you know, actually, I don't think closure actually exists except in our minds. You know, I don't think there's ever really closure. You know, in Zen, you know, classic style of practice is never to encourage that sense of an ending or culmination. You just keep rolling, right? You just keep rolling. And the truth is, you know, koan practice is a little bit like the parable of the elephant. You might know this, but when the Buddha was trying to teach people, he was having sesshin. You know, Lord Buddha had situations like this. And people would have experiences on the cushion. And you know, they wouldn't always know what the experience meant or how to interpret it. And the Buddha said, look, you know, enlightenment is so vast, it's so huge and complicated from a certain standpoint, that I don't think it's a good idea to try to grasp it all at once. Let's just take it one step at a time. And so, you know, he said, you take it one piece at a time, and eventually you'll be able to put it all together. So basically, you know, there's this parable of the blind men. So there's these blind men go in and they find an elephant. Each blind man grabs the elephant at a different point. So you know, somebody grabs the leg and they say, an elephant is like a tree, like a mighty tree. That's not wrong, but it's just a piece, right? Somebody else grabs the trunk and says, an elephant is like a snake, you know. Somebody else grabs an ear and they say it's like a leaf, you know, and so on. These are all experiences of the elephant, but they have to all, they add up to something bigger than the trunk, the snake, and the leaf, you know. But koan training is sort of asking you to experience one little piece of reality at a time. It's saying, if it says hot water, cold water, it's asking you to notice something about the moment that's as different as hot water, cold water. If it's three pounds of flax, it's asking you to notice something about the moment that has three aspects, see. You might experience something on the cushion that's the quote-unquote right answer, and it still might not make any sense when you leave the Dokusan room. And even if you have the right answer, there's still more of the elephant to understand. So in a way, you know, closure is kind of a false achievement. We have a psychological need for closure, but there's never closure. There's never closure. The truth is, I don't think you really want, Matt, this is sort of presumptuous of me, but I don't think you really want closure, you know? We think we do, but I don't think we really want it. You know, I guess we've all had the experience of wanting something badly and then getting it and then finding it rather a non-event, right? It's like, I don't know about you, but my graduation, my college graduation was like a total non-event, right? I mean, when I got to college, I was really excited about college. But at the end, I didn't even want to go to my graduation, because at that point, it had ceased to be important to graduate from college because I had graduated, you know. And I think maybe you've had that experience. You know, you want a promotion, and you think, if I can just get this promotion, and then you get the promotion, and it's like, well, now what? You know? So I'm not sure closure is really such a good thing anyway. You know, there's always something more to learn. There's always more to the elephant. So So if you come into the Dokusan room and the teacher says, oh, that's wonderful, I think in American context, you need to do that. Because we've all been raised with a classical modern education system where the course is broken down into stages and steps, and you keep getting tested and evaluated. You know, so my nephew is an engineer at Virginia Tech now, my brother's son. And he's like obsessively, compulsively motivated to get good grades. And he's just like insane about getting good grades. And if he gets less than an A, he almost feels ill. He said it ruins his week if he doesn't get an A. And, you know, I've tried to talk to him and say, well, you know, really, that's not a very healthy mindset. But he this is like the way, he thinks this is the path to success and so on. But, you know, this is just the way we're conditioned. So if you look at Dokusan like testing situation, it's going to make you unhappy for a while, until you get over it, until you stop looking at it that way. You know, if you see it as every koan is like a test, and it's an exam, and so what that means is that you're failing every day you don't pass the koan. See? So this is like a depressing scenario, isn't it? I mean, I actually have had very much this mindset for a long time. I mean, because I'm a product of this culture too, and believe it or not, you know, when I was in high school, I was very scrawny, and I had a bad complexion, and there were no girls who would go out with me. Not a single one. And that might not surprise you at all. So, you know, basically, the only way I could distinguish myself was to try to be a good student. So I became like really good, the best student in my high school. It was a little high school in Southern Virginia. And I really pushed myself very hard to be excellent. And I too, like my nephew, if I didn't get A's, it would ruin my whole week. You know. And I came to crave the respect and admiration of my teachers. I wanted to be the best student in the class. And so when I started doing Zen practice, I wanted to be the best student in the class. And when I went into Dokusan, I desperately wanted to give a dazzling answer. Right? And of course, I really walked into the wrong tradition. Right? Because Genki Roshi never, if you were Buddha himself, he wouldn't go, that's a good answer. You know, he wouldn't have done it. He'd go, well, all right, Buddha, I guess I'll pass you. Or I'll give you another call on. So, did I have enlightenment or not? So I set myself up for a long period of unhappiness because I craved, you know, I wanted to be real and I wasn't. And I wanted to be real by seeing my reality acknowledged by my teacher. So there's a complex psychological dynamic to all of this. So when my teacher would just go next or ring the bell or thank you, bye, you know, it was devastating. And for a long time I would come to these sesshins and I would feel the pain of in my legs with nothing compared to the pain in my heart from getting F's on my exams, my Zen exams. But this is a difficult experience and it calls for all of us to grow and become deeper as people or as not people, as a matter of fact. It requires us to grow and become natural beings and become like the monkeys, to get back to the first day. You know, it's really a big mistake to try to have a self. really, you know. And basically, this is all part of like a self system, self maintenance system. So, you know, at some point, you know, you go into Dokusan and you don't get the answer, and you go into Dokusan and you don't get the answer. And, you know, at some point you could just quit doing Zen. And I want you to know that if you quit, I'll always be your friend. I mean that. If I see you on the street, I won't look at you with a cold stare. or you know, contempt. No. That wouldn't be compassion, right? And hopefully we'd still be, you know, I'd still be happy to see you. I mean, I would. But the thing is, you know, you could quit, you know, but or you can change, you know, and you have a choice. You know, either be perpetually unhappy or change. And so it's like growth. You have to grow. And basically, a person who does Zen doesn't crave success, because a person who does Zen is trying to become liberated from the illusion of a permanent self. Yeah. So the desire for an A on the test, the people have different motives for pursuing knowledge. Sometimes it's compassion, and sometimes it's self-aggrandizement, or confirming the self. And sometimes it's curiosity. And those are all different motives, and they're not all the same. You know, the passion to understand is a very high, noble motive, I think, and to help others also. To be a self is, I think, a less healthy motive, actually, my personal feeling is. So basically, you know, we usually have like a complex mixture of those emotions, those motives. But really, it's very important just to give up on the desire for success, and you begin to live a different kind of life. There's a certain kind of person I just admire so much, who can just eat failure from now until the cows come home, you know? And that takes great trust in life. You know, you read about somebody like, this is not necessarily the best example, but it's the one that comes to my mind right now. You know, during the American Civil War, the North was losing battle after battle. And all of these generals who were considered really like top generals, they just couldn't win. It was ludicrous, right? They would get beaten so badly. They were like these hapless, uncreative people who couldn't change. And of course their opponent was the Southern general, Robert E. Lee, was like this brilliant, brilliant inventive strategist. And you know, these guys who were all highly respected just got slaughtered on the battlefield. Thousands of people got killed in these incredible defeats. They were just ludicrous, and the failures were so awful because these generals were disorganized. They didn't get all the troops on the battlefield at the right time. They didn't build the bridges before they tried to move their troops. It was like ludicrous. So finally, there was a guy named Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, who was had retired from the army and was re-enlisted and had a drinking problem. And so people didn't think that necessarily very highly of Grant. But it finally, you know, they couldn't find anybody who would run the Union Army, so they gave it to Grant. And Grant went up against Lee, and he kept losing and losing. But he didn't stop. He didn't stop. And eventually he won the war. And you know, he had psychological difficulties with these defeats. And they weren't just defeats like not answering your koan. They were defeats in which thousands of people died. So after one of his battles, when Grant got the casualty figures, he sat in his tent all night and wept and his officers could hear him crying. You know, but he got up the next day, he wiped off his face, and he went back. And that was the difference between him and all these other generals. And Grant didn't do Zazen, and he was a warrior. And that's a complex situation, something you might not want to be in your life. But the thing is, he found a way not to be daunted by failure. Somehow he had a deeper life. And Zen practice is like that, You're either going to quit or you're going to develop a deeper life. And developing a deeper life means not living in the small self. There are some people who practice Zen because they want to get out of pain. That was like me when I started. I didn't want to wake up. I just wanted to stop being in psychological pain and fear, like I was haunted by fear. And for a long time, I wanted to have a self and to be out of pain. And this created a lot of conflict for me. Because when I was going to Sesshin, I would try to have beautiful experiences, Now, there's nothing wrong with having wonderful experiences. So, don't think I'm saying, don't enjoy your practice or something like that. I enjoy my practice every single day. I mean, honestly, or I wouldn't be here. I love it. I've had wonderful sits all day long. And I had wonderful sits yesterday. And I love my practice. So I'm not saying don't enjoy yourself or something like that. It's not a mistake to be happy. There's a way of trying to have wonderful experiences, trying to have a breakthrough experiences, or trying to have tensho experience, or trying to have a memorable experience. So when we go to Sesshin sometime, we want to have a Sesshin where we're going to be lifted high or dropped low, or both. And basically, we want a Sesshin where we can say at the end, this was really something else. I tell you, I felt like I was, I never had an experience like that before, et cetera, et cetera. And this is a what we want to have is like a unique experience that we can hold on to. And this is a kind of closure again, right? It's like we're putting a photo in the scrapbook of our life. And we can say, Sesshin, May, June, 2006. This is the one where, I had an amazing experience. This is part of the constructing the narrative of the self. Right? Now, in the modern world, there's like two different, the dominating way of thinking in the modern world is to have a self. This is a whole civilization is about the self and its adventures. Right? And so, we're always trying to have a self and to have a rich life, so-called rich life. We want a rich life. And that means, there's a book that that Bill Clinton has been reading, and indeed my wife has been reading. And it's called something like The 1,000 Places You Should Go To Before You Die. And it's like, oh no. First of all, I love my wife, but I was so sorry to see her bring home that book, Because it's like, oh no. Because this is now there's a competition, right? How many can you check off, off the list before time runs out. Have these great experiences. Right? You haven't lived a rich life. It's like, oh no. So this is like classic, though. So it's like we're going to compete for who has the thickest scrapbook of world travels. And if I don't go anywhere, I haven't had a rich life. See, this is the problem with this way of thinking. And it is necessary to have a self. You have to have a self, in fact, before you can lose yourself. But the self is inherently unsatisfactory. at least that was the Buddha's opinion. The Buddha said, Buddha had a self too. When people said Siddhartha, he didn't not answer. He knew, you know. He had had a well-developed life. He had been married. He had been, it was apparently according to the legend, a prince, but he had been really like a tribal chieftain, basically, would probably be what he was. Son of a tribal chieftain. And you have an identity. You know, you don't go to somebody else's apartment at night. You know, you get your check. I get a check too. You know, it says Kurt Spellmeyer. And I smile and I put it in my pocket. So I'm happy to get it. You know? When I get my check, I don't give it away. I put it in the bank. So it's important to have a self. It's not something to be ashamed of, or to, you know, the effort to be selfless is a kind of egotism too, right? You know, it's okay to, you know, have clothes that look decent. And, you know, so I'm not saying this is a sinful or bad or something like that. But the Buddha said to be a self is an inherently unstable and unsatisfactory situation. Right, because it's characterized by constant insecurity and continuous craving and disappointment. And this is so true, in my opinion. It's so true. You know, we're constantly trying to be ratified by someone who will say, you are real. You are real. You know, you are real. And you can say, finally. But you know, there's so much evidence that indicates that we're not real, that the self is not real. You know, my mother has Alzheimer's disease, and it's so interesting. She has all these scrapbooks, and they're filled with pictures that she can't identify anymore. So, you know, when we were moving her into the assisted living arrangement, I said, you know, we were looking through some of these pictures, and my mother's very possessive of her pictures. So, you know, I was trying to help her through the situation, and I sat down and said, do you remember this picture? It was my mother with her mother and her sister. And she said, I don't remember who those people are. So it's like, you know, the self is, you know, we want to store up all these wonderful memories, but in fact we can't even hold on to them. They're all going to go away. You know, and, you know, there's nobody really, in my opinion, who can ratify my existence for me. Because when I enter deep mushin, everything disappears, including myself. Yeah? And when I go to the core of my being, there isn't anybody home. You know? It's empty. But the strange thing is that when I go there, I feel great. Not bad, great. You know? On the other hand, when I'm trying to be approved of by my colleagues or anybody else, and I'm desperately trying to be liked, you know, I don't feel great. I feel rather pathetic. You know. So it is necessary to, it's good not to live in a cave, you know, and so on. It's important to develop social skills. In fact, one of the problems with my feeling about some people who have gone through like classical monastic trainings, they don't have any social skills. And so it's good to be, you know, a person who lives in the world and understands how the world works. But we Zen people don't try to be, we don't try too hard to be a self. Because we know it's inherently unstable and unsatisfactory. See? And so, you know, when you're not worried about being a self, the problem of failure disappears altogether. It's not a problem anymore. See? And that's a wonderful, I believe that's a wonderful way to live. Because then it becomes possible to really engage with the world without being so afraid of failure. And being so afraid of not being real. Because, you know, don't worry about it, you're not. You know, and I'm not. Really and truly, it's the worst thing in the world for most people is not to be real, not to be a self, to say, I haven't really lived. But you know, we Zen people spend a lot of our time in what we call the unborn. the unborn. If somebody says, have you, you know, at the end of my life, if somebody asks me, Kurt, have you really lived? I hope I have my faculties enough to say, no, definitely not. Definitely not. And people say, how many hours do you meditate every day? You know, it's like, what a pathetic waste. You know, you could be traveling, you could be... I'm not that interested in my scrapbook, you know. It's just not that interesting to me. You know, I'm not putting it down if that's... But let me just say, I believe it's inevitably the case that you will be anxious and fearful about your scrapbook. And you will be troubled all the time because, you know, you'll say, well, do I have, my scrapbook's not as thick as so-and-so's. You know, I don't have my pictures are a little, I don't have the new camera. You know, these are old style photographs. And this is the life of the self. The self is based upon imitation of other selves who are also unreal. And everybody's hiding it from each other. This is the human world, right? We're all pretending to be these beings. We've invented, you know, we've invented. And basically we're all trying to convince each other that we're real, but constantly like reality is erupting to show us that we're not, you know, that we're impermanent, transient, fallible, unstable. The self is not even continuous, you know. And so it creates kind of like a neurotic social world. And as I say, you need a self. That humans need to live in civilization, so-called. But if they live there totally, they go crazy, you know, because it's inherently an unhappy place, as a matter of fact. And you can fill your scrapbook up with all the beautiful session experiences in the world, and you still wouldn't be happy. Happiness, and I only can speak for myself. Happiness comes from having nothing and being nowhere, and being no one. When I sit on the cushion and enter Mushin, I feel such joy. I feel deeply connected to everything around me, and I feel just like I'm sitting at the heart of life. And you don't have to travel anywhere, it's not expensive, you don't need any special clothes, you know. Nobody has to see it, right? Nobody has to see it, it's real. So, This is, you know, the life of Zen is a bigger life. It's not becoming desensitized to failure. It's getting beyond the craving for a self to be approved of. And that kind of a being is like indestructible, right? That kind of a being is like totally free. You know, in Japan they have what they call Daruma dolls. It's a Bodhidharma, and these dolls are used in all kinds of occasions. But they're made so that their bottom, the doll is actually shaped a little bit like a bowling pin, like a fat bowling pin. And basically, Daruma's head is the top of the bowling pin, and his arms are painted on the side, and he's been doing zazen. You know, of course, he's been doing zazen so long, and his legs are tucked up under him, right? And he's kind of chubby. So he just looks like a bowling pin, sort of a fat one. And the bottom is rounded, see, rounded, and there's a weight in the bottom of the Daruma doll. So if you push him over, he bounces right back, right? This is kind of a dumb idea, I guess. But it's suggesting, see, nothing gets him down. Nothing. Push him over, bounces back. Push him over, bounces back. Now he's degenerated into, when they have an election, the winning party paints one of his eyes in his head. So it's lost its Zen significance, and it's being used for another purpose. But in its original meaning, it was like sort of saying, look, You know, this is the way of Zen, is to you bounce right back from defeat, because there is no defeat. There is no self to be defeated, you know. And you just harmonize yourself. You go, you know, there's this saying from the 60s, go with the flow. But actually, that's a great wisdom, in my opinion. You know, you keep going and going and going. You move with the universe. The universe has changed. You know, in a million years, there probably won't be any humans. You know, this is something people find so unthinkable, but some other life form will have taken our place. And this is how it has to be. You know, but it shouldn't trouble us, because we live in a deeper realm. You know, we live out of we were something long before we were human. We were something else. And then we became human. And someday we won't be human. We'll be something else. There's a part of us that isn't human. It taps into the universe. And that's where we Zen people live our lives. See? Simeon. I see you, Simeon. It's like monkey says hello to monkey. Because there's something in us which is bigger than the human. It's bigger than the self. It's bigger than the self. So why be so unhappy? Why be unhappy? You know, why not live in this bigger self, this bigger life? You know? And it's an unstoppable life, you know, indestructible life. You know, I guess, you know, we just have to be unhappy long enough till we get tired of it, and then we say, oh, screw it, I don't want to be unhappy. But that means, you know, I don't really need to be yourself. I'll go to work, I'll put on my shirt, and somebody says, Kurt, I'll go, yes. But I know that's not where I'm going to live a lot of my life, spend a lot of my time. It's not worth it. It's not worth it, in my opinion. It's like fighting over scraps when there's a banquet in the other room. Right? You can be, in this koan, they don't say be a monkey, they say be a blind ass. See, a donkey is like the dumbest thing, right? A blind donkey. Holy Moses, you know. You can't get any worse than that, you know. Nobody respects a blind donkey, right? But this says be a blind donkey. Be a blind ass. You know? But maybe Lin Ji wasn't saying, it's ruined. Maybe he's saying, you've really got it, you know, because you don't care about success or failure. You know, if the survival of Zen depended upon this guy giving the right answer at that moment, then the whole enterprise is doomed from the start, right? There's something, whether you give the right answer or not, see, whether you give the right answer or not, this is a bigger life, a bigger life. And basically, it's just, please, we just have to get over ourselves and just get over ourselves and lead a bigger life. And that's so magnificent, so wonderful, in my opinion. When Lin Ji was about to die, he admonished Song Sheng, after I die, don't destroy my treasure near the Eye of Truth. Song Sheng said, I would never do that. I love the teacher. Lin Ji said, okay. When somebody asks you about the Buddha Dharma, what are you going to say? Cops! Oh, Christ! It's all down the tube. It's down the toilet. Right? Ruin. Disaster. There's no ruin. There's no disaster. That's just a fantasy of it. So please, you know, we're here. This is a beautiful life, beautiful world. Some of you are sick. You're actually practicing and you're sick. I just think that is fantastic. I think that is just, that's just so much, that's real heart, real practice. See, I mean, you can say, how was your session? No, I was sick the whole time. I felt lousy. How wonderful. Really. The small mind says, oh, well, that's not one for the scrap. That's not going in the scrap. Here I am puking in the toilet, right? No. That's not the scaffold. The bigger self says, oh, this beautiful life, this beautiful, this indestructible.